Welcome to Mysterious Topics, a podcast focusing on intriguing topics deserving further scrutiny. Each episode, the hosts examine a topic, add their opinions, and hopefully pique your interest as well. Visit MysteriousTopics.com for contact information and more. Now, here are your hosts, Chuck and John.
Hi, John.
Hello, Chuck, and hello to our listeners. Today, we'll be discussing mysterious radio bursts from space.
This is from NewScientist.com on 31st of March of 2015 by Sarah Scholes. Mysterious radio wave flashes from far outside the galaxy are proving tough for astronomers to explain. Is it pulsars, a spy satellite, or an alien message? Bursts of radio waves flashing across the sky seem to follow a mathematical pattern. If the pattern is real, either some strange celestial physics is going on, or the bursts are artificial, produced by human or alien technology. Telescopes have been picking up so-called fast radio bursts, or FRBs, since 2001. They last just a few milliseconds and erupt with about as much energy as the sun releases in a month. 10 have been detected so far, most recently in 2014, when the Parkes telescope in New South Wales, Australia, caught a burst in action for the first time. The others were found sifting through data after the bursts had arrived at Earth. No one knows what causes them, but the brevity of the burst means their source has to be small, hundreds of kilometers across at most. So they can't be from ordinary stars, and they seem to come from far outside the galaxy. The weird part is that they all fit a pattern that doesn't match what we know about cosmic physics. We have detected 10 fast bursts of radio waves, or FRBs, coming from space in the past 15 years. The delay between the arrival of the first and last waves of each burst is always close to a multiple of 187.5. No known natural process can explain that. Here we are, John, again talking about math and a number such as 187.5 being significant, and perhaps everyone in the universe or everyone that exists anywhere might have a common connection through the use of math and numbers such as this multiple of 187.5.
To calculate how far the bursts have come, astronomers use a concept called the dispersion measure. Each burst covers a range of radio frequencies, as if the whole FM band were playing the same song. But electrons in space scatter and delay the radiation, so that higher frequency waves make it across space faster than lower frequency waves. The more space the signal crosses, the bigger the difference, or dispersion measure, between the arrival time of high and low frequencies, and the further the signal has traveled. Michael Hipke of the Institute for Data Analysis at Neukirchen, Vlun, Germany, and John Learned at the University of Hawaii at Manoa found that all 10 burst dispersion measures are multiples of a single number, 187.5. This neat lineup, if taken at face value, would imply 5 sources for the bursts, all at regularly spaced distances from Earth, billions of light years away. A more likely explanation, Hipke and Learned say, is that the FRBs all come from somewhere much closer to home, from a group of objects within the Milky Way that naturally emit shorter frequency radio waves after higher frequency ones, with a delay that is a multiple of 187.5. They claim there is a 5 in 10,000 probability that the lineup is coincidence. If the pattern is real, says Learned, it is very, very hard to explain.
So what that last sentence indicates, that it's very unlikely that it is a coincidence. So that would indicate the pattern must be real.
And what that means is it's very unlikely that it is a natural radial burst or from any kind of natural stars or quasars or anything like that.
Right. Cosmic objects might, by some natural but unknown process, produce dispersions in regular steps. Small, dense remnant stars called pulsars are known to emit bursts of radio waves, though not in regular arrangements or with as much power as FRBs. But maybe super dense stars are mathematical oddities because of underlying physics we don't understand. It's also possible that the telescopes are picking up evidence of human technology, like an unmapped spy satellite masquerading as signals from deep space. The most tantalizing possibility is that the source of the burst might be a who, not a what. If none of the natural explanations pan out, their paper concludes, an artificial source, human or non-human, must be considered. Beacon from extraterrestrials has always been on the list of weird possible origins for these bursts. These have been intriguing as an engineered signal or evidence of extraterrestrial technology since the first was discovered, says Jill Tarter, former director of the SETI Institute in California. I'm intrigued. Stay tuned. Astronomers have long speculated that a mathematically clever message broadcasts encoded with pi, or flashes that count all prime numbers, as sent by aliens in the film Contact, could give away aliens' existence. Perhaps extraterrestrial civilizations are flagging us down with basic multiplication.
But a fast radio burst is definitely not the easiest message aliens could send, as Mara McLaughlin of West Virginia University, who was part of the first FRB discovery, points out. It takes a lot of energy to make a signal that spreads across lots of frequencies instead of just a narrow one like a radio station. And if the bursts come from outside the galaxy, they would have to be incredibly energetic to get this far. If the bursts actually come from inside the Milky Way, they need not be so energetic, just like a nearby flashlight can light up the ground, but a distant light does not. Either way, though, it would require a lot of power. In fact, the aliens would have to be from what SETI scientists call a Kardashev Type 2 civilization. We will have more on this in a minute. But maybe there's no pattern at all, let alone one that aliens embedded. There are only 10 bursts, and they fit into just 5 groups. It's very easy to find patterns when you have small number statistics, says McLaughlin. On the other hand, I don't think you can argue with the statistics, so it is odd. The pattern might disappear as more FRBs are detected. Hipke and Learned plan to check their finding against new discoveries and perhaps learn something about the universe. Science is the best game around, says Learned. You don't know what the rules are or if you can win. This is science in action. If the result holds up, says Hipke, there is something really interesting we need to understand. This will either be new physics, like a new kind of pulsar, or, in the end, if we can exclude everything else, an ET. Hipke is cautious, but notes that remote possibilities are still possibilities. When you set out to search for something new, he says, you might find something unexpected. And Chuck, I think that is interesting because, like they said, there was a 1 in 10,000 chance that this was a natural event based on what we know about physics at this time. If they do discover that this may be some sort of natural phenomenon, then what that means is that they have to redefine our current understanding of physics.
Yeah, that's right.
So either way, this would be an incredible mystery to unravel.
Yes, it would. Keeping up with the Kardashevs, the first search for extraterrestrial intelligence, Frank Drake's Project OSMA, looked for radio broadcasts from hypothetical aliens in the 1960s. Around the same time, cosmologist Nikolai Kardashev began to wonder what a truly advanced civilization's radio messages might be like. His main conclusion, more powerful than ours. in a 1963 paper called Transmission of Information by Extraterrestrial Civilizations. He grouped ETs into three categories according to how big their broadcasts could be. The labels stuck, and SETI scientists still use them today. The following is from quarks2quasars.com. The Kardashev scale, type 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 civilization. It's from July 19th of 2014 by Joe Garland. Theorists assert that as a civilization grows larger and becomes more advanced, its energy demands will increase rapidly due to its population growth and the energy requirements of its various machines. With this in mind, the Kardashev scale was developed as a way of measuring a civilization's technological advancement based upon how much usable energy it has at its disposal. The scale was originally designed in 1964 by the Russian astrophysicist Nikolai Kardashev, who was looking for signs of extraterrestrial life within cosmic signals. It has three base classes, each with an energy disposal level. Other astronomers have extended the scale to type 4 and type 5. He had the first three, and then other astronomers added the 4 and 5. And the energy available to this kind of a civilization, the 5, would be equal to that of all energy available, not in just our universe, but in all universes and in all timelines. These additions consider both energy access as well as the amount of knowledge the civilizations have access to.
Firstly, it is important to note that the human race is not even on this scale yet, since we still sustain our energy needs from dead plants and animals here on Earth. We are a lowly type 0 civilization, and we have a long way to go before being promoted to a type 1 civilization. The famous physicist Michio Kaku believes we will reach type 1 in 100 to 200 years' time, but what does each of these categories actually stand for in literal terms? A type 1 designation is given to species who have been able to harness all the energy that is available from a neighboring star, gathering and storing it to meet the energy demands of a growing population. This means that we would need to boost our current energy production over 100,000 times to reach this status. However, being able to harness all Earth's energy would also mean that we could have control over all natural forces. Human beings could control volcanoes, the weather, and even earthquakes. At least, that is the idea. These kinds of feats are hard to believe, but compared to the advances that may still be to come, there are just basic and primitive levels of control. It's absolutely nothing compared to the capabilities of societies with higher rankings.
And according to Michio Kaku, within 100 or 200 years, we'll be able to do that. The next step up, a Type 2 civilization can harness the power of their entire star, not merely transforming starlight into energy, but controlling the star. Several methods for this have been proposed, the most popular of which is the hypothetical Dyson sphere. This device, if you want to call it that, would encompass every single inch of the star, gathering most, if not all, of its energy output and transferring it to a planet for later use.
Yes, a Dyson sphere is a hypothetical megastructure that completely encompasses a star and hence captures most or all of its power output. It was first described by Freeman Dyson. Dyson speculated that such structures would be the logical consequence of the long-term survival and escalating energy needs of a technological civilization, and proposed that searching for evidence of the existence of such structures might lead to the detection of advanced intelligent extraterrestrial life. Different types of Dyson spheres correlate with information on the Kardashev scale. Since then, other variant designs involving building an artificial structure or series of structures to encompass a star have been proposed in exploratory engineering or described in science fiction under the name Dyson sphere. These later proposals have not been limited to solar power stations. Many involve habitation or industrial elements. Most fictional depictions describe a solid shell of matter enclosing a star, which is considered the least plausible variant of the idea. And I was looking at some of the images of this before, Chuck, and so what they're saying is this type of civilization would build a structure around, so if this were us, we would be building a structure around our sun, which would capture a lot of the energy, and then we'd be able to transport that energy to Earth to use.
That sounds like a truly advanced civilization.
Yes, and they'd be building a structure, like some of them they said less plausible around the whole star, but you would put up a huge structure like a wall or a almost like a satellite dish, but a huge, the size of one half of the sun or one side of the sun to absorb that energy and direct it back to Earth. Just think of the size, the scale of that sort of construction.
And I can imagine that any kind of energy produced by that project would be way more than would be needed. That would be just an enormous amount of energy coming from that source.
Yeah, I think they said it would be 100,000 times the amount of energy we are now producing in order to get to Type 1 civilization. But yes, it would completely supply so much energy for so many different uses. You could use that energy now to power your spacecrafts too.
Right. Although such megastructures may be theoretically possible, all plans to build a fixed-in-place Dyson sphere are currently far behind humanity's engineering capacity. However, parts of the technology like orbiting satellites and solar sails have already been developed. Deployment of spacecraft and satellites using photovoltaics might be seen as the first small steps towards building a Dyson swarm. However, the number of craft required to obtain, transmit, and maintain a complete Dyson sphere far exceeds the present-day industrial capabilities. Alternatively, a fusion power, the mechanism that powers stars, had been mastered by the race. A reactor on a truly immense scale could be used to satisfy their needs. Nearby gas giants can be utilized for their hydrogen, slowly drained of life by an orbiting reactor. What would this much energy mean for a species? Well, nothing known to science could wipe out a Type 2 civilization. Take, for instance, if humans survive long enough to reach this status, and a moon-sized object entered our solar system on a collision course with our little blue planet, we have the ability to vaporize it out of existence. Or, if we had time, we could move our planet out of the way, completely dodging it. But let's say we didn't want to move Earth. Are there any other options? Well, yes, because we'd have the capability to move Jupiter, or another planet of our choice, into the way. Pretty cool, right?
That would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
But just like El Nino, when you alter something, or like we talked about in another podcast with the HARP, the ionosphere, when you start manipulating things artificially, it may cause repercussions, or it definitely will cause repercussions elsewhere in that environment. So that would be our solar system. So if you're moving Jupiter, it would certainly have an effect on, maybe a negative effect on some of the other planets.
Yeah, it wouldn't be very fair to Jupiter, though.
Well, Jupiter, that's what we talked about before. Jupiter is, curiously enough, we were just talking about the Dyson sphere. Jupiter is like a vacuum cleaner, like a Dyson vacuum cleaner sucking up all those.
For some reason, I knew that was going to come into this discussion.
Well, we have a Dyson vacuum cleaner, so.
Okay.
So we've gone from having control over a planet to a star, which has resulted in us harboring enough disposable energy to essentially make our civilization immune to extinction. But now, on to Type 3, where a species then becomes galactic traversers with knowledge of everything having to do with energy, resulting in them becoming a master race. In terms of humans, hundreds of thousands of years of evolution both biological and mechanical, may result in the inhabitants of this Type 3 civilization being incredibly different from the human race as we know it. These may be cyborgs or cybergenetic organism beings, both biological and robotic, with the descendants of regular humans being a subspecies among the now highly advanced society. These wholly biological humans would likely be seen as being disabled, inferior, or unevolved by their cybernetic counterparts. At this stage, we would have developed colonies of robots that are capable of self-replication. Their population may increase into the millions as they spread out across the galaxy, colonizing star after star, and these beings might build Dyson spheres to encapsulate each one, creating a huge network that would carry energy back to the home planet. But stretching over the galaxy in such a manner would face several problems. Namely, the species would be constrained by the laws of physics, particularly light speed travel. That is, unless they develop a working warp drive or use that immaculate energy cache to master wormhole teleportation, two things that remain theoretical for the time being. They can only get so far.
Kardashev believed the Type 4 civilization was too advanced and didn't go beyond Type 3 on his scale. He thought that surely this would be the extent of any species' ability. Many think so, but a few believe there is a further level that could be achieved. I mean, surely there is a limit. Type 4 civilizations would almost be able to harness the energy content of the entire universe, and with that, they could traverse the accelerating expansion of space. Furthermore, advanced races of these species may live inside supermassive black holes. To previous methods of generating energy, these kinds of feats are considered impossible. A Type 4 civilization would need to tap into energy sources unknown to us using strange or currently unknown laws of physics.
Type 5, yes, Type 5 might just be the next possible advancement to such a civilization. Here, beings would be like gods, having the knowledge to manipulate the universe as they please. Now, as I said, humans are a very, very long way from ever reaching anything like this, but it's not to say that it cannot be achieved as long as we take care of Earth and each other. To do so, the first step is to preserve our tiny home, extinguish war, and continue to support scientific advances and discoveries. And Chuck, I just wanted to mention one other thing about how it seems like every movie or program out there that deals with beings from another planet, it's always interesting how when they come here and they start interacting with them, and the beings from that planet are, of course, they have their own language. They're from a planet, and they say they speak this type of language, and sometimes it's with telepathy and that, but it's the same language. A lot of times they have the same uniform. They're wearing a uniform, but of course, if we sent astronauts out, they'd all have the same clothing, so that isn't unusual. And I just thought about that, about how if somebody's coming here and they're thinking, well, these Earthlings talk like this. Well, so we still have a lot of different languages on this planet. And I just wondered if you knew how many languages are spoken in our world.
Well, I didn't know, but I do now know after reading what you put up here for us to look at.
Yeah, I'd just like our listeners to take a minute to just try to guess how many spoken languages there are in the world today. And I'll give you the answer now. You could always pause it and think about it if you want before you get the answer, but this is the answer. There are roughly 6,500 spoken languages in the world today. However, about 2,000 of those languages have fewer than 1,000 speakers. The most popular language in the world is Mandarin Chinese. There are 1,213,000,000 people in the world that speak that language. So, Chuck, just to show as an example of how far away we are from even a Type 1 civilization, we still can't even communicate with each other very well. We have 4,500 languages spoken by the majority of people and another 2,000 that have fewer than 1,000 speakers. I don't know. It's just, isn't that amazing?
It is amazing. And I can't imagine how we actually do communicate with other countries, but apparently we have learned how to do that through the use of interpreters and other sources. And it's pretty much fascinating that English is used in most airplane conversations, and as far as commercial airplanes are concerned. And that would indicate that all these pilots on these commercial airlines from all these different countries throughout the world would have to know at least some English in order to converse.
Yes, and that's the other thing about when we see in the movies about beings coming from another planet and how they talk about how their society is. But the planet that they talk about, the society, is the same on the whole planet. And here we are today with still hundreds of countries that are all doing things different, some drastically different than others.
Right.
So in order to evolve, we have to figure out a way how to communicate with each other and how to govern with each other.
I think the communication in these advanced civilizations is going to have to be some form of unspoken communication where you can just look at a person and the thoughts will be transferred without having to use a verbal language.
Right. But I just think it's fun to read about the Kardashev scale and how far we have to go, but the possibilities are there that we can evolve very far.
Yeah, it's almost overwhelming to think about it. But at the same time, it's very fascinating to do so.
And promising.
Yes. Okay. I don't have anything else on this topic. And I think I'd like to just say a few words about thanking anybody that has left a review for us at our iTunes site or whatever site you might be listening to our podcast at, and also to direct you to MysteriousTopics.com and to our Facebook page. So this is Chuck, and goodbye.
And John, thank you for listening. Goodbye.